Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today we see wine through the eyes of a scientist. Harold McGee answers the question, does the wine world's favorite concept, terroir, actually exist? It's a big marketing word these days. It means that the wine tastes of the earth that it comes from. Harold McGee's done some research. We ask the question, what happens when you drop a southern food historian, as in Hoppin' John Martin Taylor, into the middle of Sri Lanka? Then it's novelist Nicole Moniz in her book The Last Chinese Chef, a story of the profound connections in China between food and life. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get the show rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Guys, I understand you've been in Kansas City, and since this is the kickoff of the grilling season, tell me you've had some great grilled food.
Well, as the kickoff of the grilling season, one of the things you would really like to know about is a place called Woodyard Barbecue. Not only because they serve terrific barbecued food, but because, as the name suggests, it really is a woodyard. And you can go there and buy hickory, cherry, pecan, or applewood logs to make your own barbecue at home.
I thought it was owned by a Mr. Woodyard. And so, you know, for years, I was thinking, gosh, the Woodyard family really does beautiful barbecue. But in fact, as Michael said, it's kind of a homage to great wood smoking.
Well, it started simply as a place where all the other pit masters of Kansas City, which, as you know, is a big barbecue town,
right.
This is where they went to get their wood. And gradually, what they did was to start serving samples there. And gradually, it became a wonderful kind of al fresco restaurant. There's a patio. The barbecue pit is right out there, and so it perfumes the patio while you dine. And some of the barbecue there is as good as any you'll get anywhere in Kansas City.
You want to hear my absolute favorite thing there?
Sure.
And even if you don't, you're going to hear it. It is the burnt end sandwich.
Oh, yes.
Wait, say that again?
The burnt end
sandwich. Oh, the part that you always want and they never put on your plate.
Yes. You
can
get
the burnt ends of the barbecue just doused in hot sauce between two pieces of white bread.
Now, a question. Do you get to pick your wood? Because this is what I picture, right? That you've got one barbecue or whatever going with the cherry wood and one going with the hickory wood and one going with the apple wood. I mean, can you kind of pick what you want to have your food done with?
No, Lynn. You can pick your meat. Their fire is primarily hickory wood. So you can pick ribs, you can pick pulled pork, you can pick... They actually had a wonderful thing there that they were doing called hot legs, which is like hot wings but made out of chicken legs with the same flavor.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things they had, it was a special when we went there. It was burnt end chili, which was a great... It was like an all-bean chili topped with a heap of these burnt ends. What a great combination this was.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Don't you like things that are a little overcooked and a little crusty?
Absolutely. I mean, especially if it happens to have fat on it.
Oh, tons of... Yes. It's similar to what in New Orleans they call debris. You know, if you're there when they're making their po' boy sandwiches, little bits of ham and roast that fall onto the
cutting board.
And,
of course, that's what the food police tell you will... You know, kill you in 10 seconds is, you know, don't ever eat the crusty, charred part of the barbecue.
What a way to go.
I know. We will be dancing.
I am a scofflaw when it comes to that.
Right. So it's a wood yard and you can go and you can get great barbecue.
That is it.
Okay. Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
There's no secret that woman
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Iced coffee season is here big time. And for us, that means making our annual coffee essence. Now, this is great coffee, hot or cold, and the most utterly goof-proof kind to make. It is ridiculously easy. All you do is mix 1 pound of coffee with 10 to 11 cups of cold water. Let it sit overnight on the counter, then strain it. And you have a coffee concentrate that keeps in the refrigerator for 2 weeks. Now, it will be as smooth as a baby's cheek, as rich as Midas, and because no heat is used, you will have little or no acid to give you agita. Now, I think, too, that the lack of heat lets the flavors of the coffee come through that you don't normally get. Now, to make hot coffee, you just add hot water to the concentrate. For iced coffee, use ice. For cappuccino, use the coffee essence straight with lots of foam milk. The concentrate gives you dynamite coffee ice, or granita, and it turns homemade hot fudge sauce into something coffee ice cream will adore. So remember, 1 pound ground coffee, 11 cups of cold water, 11 hours on the counter, strain, and that's it. What happens when you take a culinary historian who's concentrated years on his own home territory and drop him in the midst of a totally different world? Well, John Martin Taylor is the master of the food of America's Lowcountry, of Charleston, and of the coasts of South and North Carolina. Well, recently he ended up at the other end of the earth, in Sri Lanka. Hey, John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Lynn. It's great to be on.
So, what did you find?
Well, I found a lot of things that surprised me, but even more surprising is that I found a lot of things that seemed awfully familiar to me. They have a Creole cuisine that reminded me so much of the cooking of Charleston in many ways, a cuisine that's based on rice to begin with, which the Charleston cuisine is, the Lowcountry cuisine is
a rice cuisine.
And all their dal, which are their beans, their peas, their pulses,
yeah,
and tons of vegetables. The vegetables, they have 365 vegetables. I remember that because it's easy, you know, the number of days of the year.
Yeah.
But so many of them are ones that we know so well in the South, like okra and sweet potatoes and yams, but many, many others I'd never seen before. And they just eat tons and tons and tons of greens.
But you said a Creole cuisine. What are the main influences?
Well, to begin with, you have to, with any cuisine, you look at where you are, and you're tropical, and they're just 9 degrees north of the equator, like Borneo and Panama. Think Panama.
Right, okay.
Or more specifically for me, think the West African countries whence came the enslaved to Charleston with their Creole cooking. But when I say Creole, I talk about a cuisine with many different influences. And the Dutch have been there. The English have been there. The Dutch had already learned from the Indonesian. You know, they had the spice companies. The Arabs had been there. All the great traders. The Portuguese were there. The Malays were there first as indentured servants. And there's a South Indian influence. But what emerges there is a tropical cuisine, a tropical Creole cuisine that is not as spicy as you would think. And in fact, it really relies on fresh vegetables and fruits, things you've never seen before.
The main foods would be what? The rice?
Well, rice. Right. And they say rice and curry. Now, interestingly, they grow 15 varieties of rice there. But they're having the same problems there that everybody's having all over the world. Is they're afraid they're losing some of these heritage breeds because they're planting other things that are more profitable. But there is a movement to maintain these rices. And I was able to taste 12 of the 15 varieties while I was there, which was great. And with the rice, of course, there is accompaniments of these sambals and malams, which are these side dishes, which are akin to the relishes and pickles and chutneys that we eat in the South. And of course, probably more as important as the rice is coconut, which they use from the water they drink out of the fresh green ones to every dish, desserts, main dishes, curries, coconut milk, breakfast, the bread, the roti is made with coconut. It's just great.
You know, I think it's hard for us to realize, because I'm thinking of the rest of the Pacific, that coconut for much of the Pacific is, and now obviously off the coast of India in Sri Lanka, is a lot like what wheat is for the Western world.
It's all throughout the equatorial regions of the earth. It's a major foodstuff, and not just a major foodstuff. It provides shelter. It provides ropes. It's fabric. The leaves are used for innumerable things. It's pretty amazing.
John, does that coconut have any connection to Charleston as well, or to the Lowcountry?
Absolutely. In my studies, Lynn, I have found coconut appearing in Charleston recipes earlier than it appears really anywhere else in the West. And it doesn't surprise me, other than the West Indies.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't surprise me because of the port there. And you know, a port's very important for a Creole cuisine. You look at the west coast of Africa in Senegal, and you look at Colombo, for that matter, in Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
The spice routes were also the slave routes, and you can actually trace recipes going from one place to another. And you see, and now that I've been to Sri Lanka, I see where so much of these ideas came from in Charleston. So yes, I see many, many influences. Early on in my research, I found a recipe that appears in all the old Charleston journals, and people still make it. By the time I was growing up, it was called mustard pickle, but in the old books, it's called atchar, and it had a double A in it, so I was, you know, I immediately thought the Dutch, and I was able to trace this recipe all the way back to Malaysia, where it originated, and where the Dutch had been and had enslaved the Malays. Mm-hmm. And you can watch this recipe go to Ceylon and to the subcontinent and to Madagascar and to South Africa, where they settled and where there were many Malaysians, up to West Africa, whence came the enslaved to Charleston. And it's unchanged throughout. It's a pickle that we serve before dinner or with alongside our complicated rice dishes the same way they do. So it's just fascinating.
The connections that you'd never expect. Hey, John, thank you.
My pleasure.
John Martin Taylor is author of Hoppin' John's Low Country Cooking and something of a curator of low country foods. You can get his recipe for sweet potatoes Caribbean style and information on his southern food picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and get information on our podcast as well as our book, How to Eat Supper. Find everything you will ever need at splendidtable.org. Coming up, scientist Harold McGee debunks the myth of terroir, and novelist Nicole Moniz introduces us to the last Chinese chef. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. We heard the term terroir used to talk about wine. It's become a buzzword in the food and wine world. The word came into use to describe what's at the heart of much of traditional winemaking. It's the idea that wine should taste of the place that it's made. Experts claim that you can taste the stone or the minerals of the soil where the grapes were grown. Terroir is also the backlash to the newer international style of winemaking, where big, lush flavors dominate, no matter where the wine comes from. Well, a while back, eminent food scientist Harold McGee and San Francisco chef Daniel Patterson did an article for the New York Times called Talk Dirt to Me. They asked the question, does terroir really exist? Well, Harold McGee joins us. Harold, welcome.
Wonderful to be here, Lynn. Thank you.
Harold, for those who aren't quite sure what terroir means, can you define it for us?
I can try. And in fact, that's sort of the nub of the whole issue is defining terroir. What does that mean? So it's a word, a French word, and it comes from a root meaning the soil, but it's come to mean the influence of a place, whatever that place may be, on the sensory qualities of the food or wine that's produced there. And so it's something that the food or wine carries with it, a kind of trace of the home from which it came.
And it's people will talk about tasting wine that they can taste the stone that the vine's roots had to reach down into and that kind of thing. You hear that so much these days.
Yes, and that's what got Daniel and me wondering about this whole thing, because we've been drinking wine for a while and enjoying it and had never noticed what people started to call minerality. They would say, you can taste the minerals. This wine comes from a granitic outcropping in Alsace, and you can taste the granite if you really concentrate on the flavor of the wine. And we had a hard time buying that, frankly, and thought it was a fascinating question. Why is it that people are all of a sudden tasting these things, which a decade or two ago no one ever mentioned when they talked about the flavors of wine? And what was really true? Is it possible that you could be tasting these things in a wine?
So, Harold, is it true?
As far as we can tell, no. Now, in science, it's hard to say absolutely flatly no about anything, because there are always, you know, qualifications, different circumstances, and so on. But if you ask a couple of basic questions, do minerals in soil go directly from the soil into the grape so that we could taste them there? And the second question, do we taste minerals? What does granite taste like? And those are the questions we looked at and looked to science to help us understand. And what we found were some interesting facts. One is that plants are very selective about what they choose to absorb from the soil. So it's simply not the case that the minerals in granite will go from the granite rock into the moisture around the plant, and then from the moisture into the root of the plant, and then from the root of the plant directly into the grape. That just doesn't happen. It's a much more complicated process, and the plant chooses which minerals to absorb, and then it allocates them in different parts of the plant depending on what's needed. And then when it comes to the flavor itself, if you think about it, granite is essentially silicon and aluminum and minerals like that, which really don't have much flavor. So perhaps what people are thinking of when they say that a wine tastes like granite is that it reminds them of the smell, for example, if you're hiking in the mountains and it's been raining, and you know how sometimes you get that kind of aroma of the rock around you.
Maybe that's
what they have in mind. But that's a very different thing from saying you can taste the granite from the soil in the grape, because it just doesn't get there that way.
What reaction have you had from winemakers?
Well, it's been mixed, and so far fairly quiet. We were expecting a lot more of a reaction than we've gotten so far, although maybe the responses are being prepared even as we speak. We've gotten really two different sets of reactions. One, the reaction we sort of expected, which was, you know, I don't really know what the details are as you describe them. All I know is what I taste, and I can taste the rock in there, and how else can you explain these flavors that I sense except by that way? But other people have said, you know, we've been wondering the same things. We've been wondering exactly how you do get those flavors. We've been wondering why we can notice similar flavors coming from very different vineyards with very different soils. And there, I think, is a realization, even among winemakers, that the flavor of wine is a much more complicated and, in a way, wonderful construction than simply extracting minerals from the soil. After all, if that were all there were to it, then all you'd have to do is take a kind of salt shaker with whatever minerals you wanted, granite or limestone, you name it,
right.
Shake a little bit in there, and you've got instant terroir. And that would be terrible if you could just kind of fake it that way. And in fact, that's not what happens.
I wonder, because I'm thinking about the fact that this concept of terroir can apply to food as well. Make a cheese in one place with seemingly the same milk, same kind of animal, etc., age it the same way, and it will taste different because of maybe the yeasts or whatever it is, than it may mm-hmm. taste in the next valley.
Mm-hmm.
But it also may be about the mentality of the person who's making it, the culture that surrounds it. That has to carry over to wine, doesn't it? That there's a transformation that goes beyond just what the soil gives something.
Exactly. And in fact, one of the pioneering wine scientists, a man named Émile Peynot, who was active in the post-war years in Bordeaux, made exactly that point long, long ago when he said that people talk about trying to achieve the natural flavors of a wine, but in fact, there's really nothing natural about the flavor of a wine. A wine is a kind of collaboration between nature, the soil, the climate, the plant, the grapes, the yeasts, the barrels, and the winemaker, who coordinates all those things and acts as kind of an orchestra conductor to make sure that the result is harmonious. And that's the real magic, I think, of wine and of any wonderful food, is that it's this collaboration between nature on the one hand and culture on the other that gives us those sensations.
You know, Harold, I think you may be the most reasonable scientist I know. And also one of the most wondering of ones. And hey, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Lynn.
Food scientist Harold McGee is author with Chef Daniel Patterson of the article Talk Dirt to Me, which appeared in the May 6, 2007 issue of The New York Times. Harold is also author of the seminal book on food and cooking. You'll find information on both on the website, splendidtable.org. What you may not know about acclaimed novelist Nicole Moniz, she's the author of A Cup of Light and Lost in Translation, is that she first went to China in the 1970s, not as a writer, but she went to open a textile business. Now, she ran that business for 18 years and in the process became a student of Chinese life and food. In China, the two are not separated, ever. Which is at the heart of her novel. It is called The Last Chinese Chef. Nicole, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole, this book is about two people, and there is a third person that seems to be a force underneath the story. Can you briefly tell us the story?
Yes, it's the story of Maggie McElroy. She's a widowed American food writer who's lost her passion for food, and she's struggling to get over her husband's death. When she gets a paternity claim filed against her husband's estate in China, she has to go to investigate, and she's given an assignment to profile a chef named Sam Liang, the second person you're mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
He's a young, rising culinary star. He's an American, but he's half Chinese, and he's gone back to China to cook. As Maggie gets to know Sam, as the novel unfolds, and she also gets to know his family, who are all obsessed with food, she finds something that she least expected, that this incredible cuisine and these people who are so passionate about it bring her soul back to her.
Now, there is this third character in the book. It's the namesake of the book, The Last Chinese Chef. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
That would be Sam's grandfather, Liang Wei. He wrote a famous food classic in 1925 called The Last Chinese Chef, and mm-hmm. he was an apprentice in the Forbidden City in the last days of imperial rule. When the Qing Dynasty fell in 1911, feudalism crumbled and all these traditions were collapsing, arranged marriages, foot-binding, Confucian values, And I'm sure, like a lot of people, he feared civilization, including culinary culture, was going to come to an end. That's why he called his book The Last Chinese Chef.
And you quote him through the book as he's almost the marker from one part of the story to the next. Is he a real person? I mean, is this book real?
No. I'm glad that you suspect it might be. It's an invented Chinese food classic, and he's an invented character. But I will say that nothing in The Last Chinese Chef, in the excerpts from this book within a book, is invented. All of the ideas in it are taken from existing food classics or interviews with food scholars or papers they have published and so on.
Nicole, I want to go back to that idea that you were talking about that profound sense of food in China. There is a passage where Sam is talking to Maggie, and he's focusing on the Chinese approach to cooking. Could you share that with us?
Sure. He's telling her about the criteria of excellence in cooking, and he says, "Remember I told you we strove for formal ideals of flavor and texture? This dish is a perfect example. One of the most important peaks of flavor is xian. Xian means the sweet, natural flavor, like butter, fresh fish, luscious, clear chicken broth. Then we have xiang, the fragrant flavor. Think frying onions, roasted meat. Nong is the concentrated flavor, the deep, complex taste you get from meat stews or dark sauces or fermented things. Then there is the rich flavor, the flavor of fat. This is called you'er buni, which means to taste of fat without being oily. We love this one. Fat's very important to us, not something undesirable to be removed and thrown away, not in China. We have a lot of dishes that actually focus on fat and make it delectable. Bring pork belly to the table when it's done right, and Chinese diners will groan with happiness. That's different," she said, scribbling. "What else? That's just flavor. We have texture. There are ideals of texture, too, three main ones. Cui is dry and crispy. Nun is when you take something fibrous, like shark's fin, and make it smooth and yielding. And ruan, that's perfect softness. Velveted chicken, a soft-boiled egg. I think it's fair to say we control texture more than any other cuisine does. In fact, some dishes we cook have nothing at all to do with flavor, only texture. That is all they attempt. Think of bechamel or wood ear. We dress these with sauces, yes, but plain sauces, way in the background. Anything more would distract. The gourmet is eating for texture."
Nicole, this is so different from the way Westerners look at food. What other things are different in China in terms of food?
To me, after all the research I did, I found that one of the most profound differences was also the most deep reason for this great food obsession in China. And that's a force that touches every aspect of Chinese life, always has, and still does today. It's called guanxi. Guanxi means relationship, connectedness. It's like a net of mutuality and obligation that holds society up there. Everything runs on relationships. It's how people get things done. And it's food, people eating together, that keeps this engine of guanxi going. Relationships are cemented at the table. They're created at the table. You can't get anything done until you know and trust people. You can't do that until you dine together, preferably more than once. And this link, this profound link between food and relationship, is at the heart of the novel, too. So even though it's a book about Chinese cuisine, the story is really universal because we all have times when we need a little help in calling back the soul.
But it seems that with what you describe in the book, the sensibility of what's on that plate and what's behind it, it seems like everyone is highly sensitized to that. I mean, is that just the book or is that real?
Oh, no. In China, cuisine calls up art. It refers to history. It makes references to poetry. And an entire culture and a river of civilization, in the best of all worlds, is brought to life and symbolized by a great meal. At the heart of this also is the relationship between the chef and the gourmet, between the cook and the muse. Without the person of taste and discernment who can grasp these references and applaud them, there really is no artist.
Hmm. Nicole, thank you.
Thank you.
Award-winning novelist Nicole Moniz is author of The Last Chinese Chef. Nicole pointed out another aspect of guanxi, or connectedness, that we see every time we go to a Chinese restaurant. Food is always served in communal dishes. It is never served on an individual dinner plate.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
Pick up that phone. The number is 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. We have got Gail calling from Reno. Hey, Gail, what do you want to talk about?
Well, years ago in the 50s, my mom used to make us cake donuts. And I wanted to make them for my grandson, and I can't find her recipe.
Uh-huh.
They were very doughy, not terribly sweet or oily, just very cake-like.
Yeah.
And they were deep-fried.
Right.
Of course. And I believe they had baking powder in them.
And they would, because there's essentially two types of donuts. There's the ones that are risen with yeast, and then there are the cake donuts, which use baking powder or baking powder and baking soda. I have to tell you, off the top of my head, I don't have a recipe, but I can direct you to some places where you might find one.
Okay, great.
Joy of Cooking.
Now, I did check there.
Oh, you did?
And I couldn't find
anything. Did you by any chance check an older issue, like one from the 70s? Because the Joy of Cooking was redone in the late 90s.
Uh-huh.
And the new version may not have the donuts in it, but the older versions do.
Okay.
There's another book, and this book has been around for a long time, but it's the kind of thing that you might find online. James Beard did a book called American Cookery.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he had donuts in there.
Okay.
One of the things that you're going to find is it is not terribly different from something like a scone recipe.
Oh, okay.
Or a biscuit recipe. And I just realized there's one other place to look. I think the book is just called Donuts, John T. Edge. Mm. And there are a bunch of recipes in the back of the book. It's a small book.
Okay.
Okay.
I will try those.
Go there, because that's recent. That's in the past year or two.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Take care. Okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is about Chinese dining etiquette. What does the fish dish at a Chinese banquet tell you about the status of the guests? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be going back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. We're going to be back to your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was about Chinese dining etiquette. Here it is. What does the fish dish at a Chinese banquet tell you about the status of the guests? Well, the head of the fish will always be pointed at the guest of honor, and the guest of honor will be presented the choicest part of the fish by the host. That part is the head, with the sweetest meat that's in the cheeks. Now, if you don't think you can handle the honor, you're supposed to delegate the person on your left or turn the platter so the head faces your host. Now, the host, or the least important person at the dinner, will be seated nearest the door or where the server stands. And by the way, to eat rice properly, bring the rice bowl up to your mouth. Don't try to eat it from the bowl right on the table. And one last thing, never finish every last morsel from the common platters or from your rice bowl. That signals your host that there wasn't enough to eat. Okay, let's get back to your calls. Pick up that phone. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. 52. Okay, let's see who has been waiting patiently. We have got Josh calling from Owensboro, Kentucky. Hey, Josh, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I was hoping to talk about I'm having a grill out this weekend and wanted to know if you had any ideas.
Well, you know, one of my favorite things is, and I think it's an overlooked piece of meat, is to take the pork butt, which is the shoulder, and slice it or have it sliced so that it's about an inch thick and it's in steaks. And you do a slow grill on that. You've got to have a lot of marbling in it. But, you know, that's the cut that the great barbecued pork comes from.
Oh,
That's slow cooked. But if you do, it's like slow grilling a steak. And you can marinate it if you want. Give it a, 20 minutes, a half hour on the side of the grill that's low, and it'll get really crusty. That is just like eating heaven. It is.
Oh, man.
It's just great. And it's, you can do it in a shorter time than you can do ribs. But it has that fabulous flavor. And one of the things I want to try with it this summer, I've not done this yet. You know, one of the guys who is really one of the great grill masters is Steve Reichlin. He wrote the Barbecue Bible and a couple of other books on barbecue. And in, I think, Barbecue Bible, he had this great recipe for onion water. It's from Afghanistan. And if I remember, it's just a matter of you throw an onion into a food processor.
Okay.
And, you know, you have this really acidic, oniony flavor. And you just drop your meat in that for maybe a half hour, not more, because it's so strong. But what I wanted to do was to do that with Tabasco sauce in it. And then I thought you would take that, leave it in for about a half hour, pull that out, and then just do the slow grill and see what happens. Because I just think the acidity and the flavor of the onion with the heat of the Tabasco, somehow to me that just seems it would be awfully good, especially with pork that's all crusty and succulent and lush.
Well, definitely. Yeah, that sounds great.
And you can do that in, you can do that in chunks that are not super big, so people can have a little taste if they want it.
Right, exactly. Now, I had another, just a quick question, maybe get your opinion on something. Around this area, there's a lot of mutton barbecue. And I was wondering if you had any...
Wait a minute. Yeah, you're in Kentucky.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I've ever had barbecued mutton, but I understand it's fabulous.
Oh, it is. It's wonderful. There's a couple of really popular restaurants, Moonlight Barbecue, Old Hickory Barbecue here in Owensboro. Basically, they barbecue mutton a whole lot like they barbecue chicken. I mean, I'm sure I'll get crucified for saying that, but basically, I was wondering if there's any sort of on-the-grill in the backyard sort of barbecue you could think of to do with a mutton steak or anything.
Yeah,
like
well, you know what this brings me back to? There used to be, maybe it's still there, years and years ago, there was a place called Keen's Chop House in New York that did mutton, and everybody turned up their nose at mutton. This was like eating great steak, and they served, you know, double-thick, medium-rare mutton chops that brought you to your knees. And what I'm thinking is if you've got that quality mutton, whatever you can do with beef, you can do with the mutton.
Oh, okay.
So if you think of it in those terms, that you would be able to take the mutton, and if you've got, you know, a piece of the rib or a piece of the loin that you could treat like a steak. The only thing I would be concerned about is that once you have it, cut it as thick as you can. Get it cut thick so it's going to give you more control when you're cooking.
Okay.
And get it, you know, you grill, you know how to do this, but, you know, there should always be one side of your fire that tends to be hot and one side of your grill that tends to be cooler.
Right, exactly.
So I would start it searing it at that hot end, but I would cook it really slow once both sides of it were seared. Because that's your insurance policy, that in case the meat's a little on the chewy side, because mutton is more mature meat, you're going to still be able to cook it slow. And there's a basic rule. The slower you cook protein of any kind, the juicier and more tender it's going to be.
Oh, and,
yeah, it's just sort of a rule of thumb. If you remember that, you know, no matter how you're cooking it, you're going to probably be in pretty good shape. But I think whatever works with beef is going to work with that mutton.
Oh, that sounds great.
Well, you know, I think you're going to have a whole crowd that's going to have a little bit of everything to eat. And
I think so, and we'll try out some new things, thanks to you
Weekend. Thank you, sir, and you have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. You know that business about, you know, whatever you do with beef, you can do with mutton? You know, it's really interesting. When trash fish first started to become popular. Trash fish, I mean fish that weren't the fillet of sole or whatever. We're going back a long time ago, but it was the tilapia and the tilefish and all this other stuff that's now ordinary. It all was stuff that had much stronger flavor than we were used to. Most of the fish that people ate was kind of bland. And the key was that if it was a sauce that worked with beef or pork, it was probably a sauce that was going to be pretty tasty with some of that fish. It's an interesting thing to remember where you can switch. Anyway, call us, 800-537-5252. We have Kathleen calling from Los Angeles. Kathleen, what do you want to talk about?
Basically, my question revolves around the fact that I have been doing some elder care lately.
Uh-huh.
And dealing with older people, now they're from 80 to 95 or 96.
Yeah.
Their taste buds are going. And in cooking for them, I've been hearing, this doesn't taste like chicken.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And do you know anything about how the taste buds age, and perhaps what food would be good in or flavoring or seasoning so they could taste something?
The general, again, I'm not an expert in this area, but a little bit because my mother was in that age group, and I fed her, and she loved to eat, but she would get very frustrated because she knew her taste buds were going.
Yeah.
But evidently, the first sensitivity that goes is sensitivity to salt and sweetness, taste for that. And then after that is bitter and sour. And what I was doing with her is I was heightening flavors. I wasn't hitting her over the head, but I was using, for instance, she couldn't have a lot of salt, so I would use acidic things that I would boil down. So, for instance, I'd brown the onions and I'd boil some vinegar into that.
Okay.
You know, I'd add a little bit of wine because that opens up flavors.
Okay.
I would use more fresh herbs than I might normally use. They still remained relatively gentle.
Uh-huh.
But it was that everything was more flavored than I would normally eat it.
Yeah.
And that she responded to. The other thing I learned, which was so interesting, is that we get older, we produce less saliva. Yeah, and as we produce less saliva, the way we experience food, aside from the fact that the taste buds begin to diminish and the atrophy, is that we actually experience the taste slightly differently. And this was where, and also you don't digest the same way. So I tended to lean toward things that were very moist. So I not all the time, you know, she still could polish off half of roast chicken in 2 seconds, you know, and loved it. But I would put a lot of lemon and garlic on that chicken.
Yeah, well, that's what I've been doing is using a lot of garlic, but still I didn't taste the garlic. So maybe
it's the heightening thing. It's rather like you're wearing earmuffs and you have to have the music turned up even louder because it has to get through the earmuffs.
Yeah.
But if you do that, there is the experience of the taste and there is the pleasure.
All right, so basically just experiment until you reach the peak.
And intensify. You know, when you're doing anything that has a broth or a sauce, boil it down to intensify its flavor.
Okay, that sounds great.
Yeah, and rather than doing the salt stuff and stuff that could be tricky for people with health difficulties.
Yeah. Also, was there a study at Yale that I think I heard on your program probably several years ago about taste buds?
Dr. Linda Bartoshuk. And this was quite a while ago, but it was about the fact that we all divide up. We all have different numbers of taste buds on our tongues. And according to the number of taste buds, we experience taste differently.
Uh-huh.
So someone with a lot of taste buds might be what's called a super taster, which means that tastes are acute for them.
Uh-huh.
In fact, some tastes are almost painful for them.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the medium tasters, which is where a lot of us fall. And by the way, a lot of people who love to eat fall in that category. And then there's the what they called non-tasters. They experience flavor, but they experience it in a different way.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. And that's true, you know, in your youth, in your middle age. It's just the way we're all built.
Good. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And thanks for a great question.
Okay, good.
You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252. We have Jeremy on the line from Iowa City. Jeremy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I wanted to talk about freezing bread dough.
Okay.
I have this really nice sourdough starter that I use to make loaves and dinner rolls, but that requires a little bit of forethought and planning ahead, and I don't always do that. And so the other, I guess it was probably about last week, we bought one of those packets of, I think the brand was Alexi, those dinner rolls that you take out and you can throw them in the oven for 15 minutes.
They're really baked.
Right.
And you just, you're defrosting them essentially in the oven and getting them crisp.
Right. So I was wondering if there's a way to do that with my sourdough recipe, if there's a way that I can basically have some rolls ready to go in the freezer and then bring them out and bake them. And if that is possible, what do I need to do in terms of modifying the recipe or adjusting bake times or letting dough thaw or anything like that?
This is my concern. There's no question that you can bake your bread, have it in the freezer, and take it out and bake it.
Mm-hmm.
That is to heat it through.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think far enough ahead, you could take it out. And this is one of the few foods you can defrost on the counter. Just take it out, let it sit on the counter for an hour or, you know, even take it out in the morning and have it in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality, although it might dry out a bit, you know, the thing with freezing is it tends to suck moisture from things.
Right.
But still, freezing baked bread, easy to do, very successful. It doesn't suffer. And then you can warm it in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
My concern about doing that with a risen loaf that is unbaked is that by the time you get the entire thing, let's say, defrosted,
mm-hmm.
the exterior part of the dough is going to be completely over-risen and it'll be it really will be a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
If you put it into the oven frozen, it's going to be the same problem. It's going to bake at all these different rates,
right.
And you're not going to get a good result. But I would bake your bread when you have the time, put it in small packages,
mm-hmm.
and then just warm them up. They'll be fabulous.
Okay.
And there's a trick. There's an old trick. My Italian grandmother did it, and then I discovered everybody's grandmother, I guess, did it. But anyway, she used to take bread that had dried out a bit but was not stale.
Mm-hmm.
And what she would do is she would just lightly wet her hand and run it over the surface of the loaf,
uh-huh.
lightly wrap it in something like foil and put it in the oven. And when it was hot all the way through, she'd open the foil and give it another few minutes and it would crisp.
Okay.
Now, you had to eat it fairly soon because if you let it sit, it would just dry out. But it was fabulous. But mm-hmm. I think bake it and freeze it and you'll be fine.
Okay. And how long will that keep in the freezer?
6 months.
6 months, okay.
Would you believe 6 months? So you've got prime, just wrap it really well, no air in the package, heavy-duty wrapping, you know, maybe one of those bags, the heavy-duty plastic bags, but push out all of the possible air,
mm-hmm.
and you'll be in good shape.
Excellent.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have Marcia calling from Indianapolis. Marcia, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I've got a question for you about sangria. I grew up in Florida, and we used to go over to Tampa to the Cuban restaurants there and mm-hmm. have such wonderful Cuban food. And as we grew up, we were able to get pitchers of sangria. So now I've got recipes for sangria, and it calls for Spanish red wine. And I've never known what kind of Spanish red wine to use. So
you got a big choice.
I was hoping you could help me with that. I've tried to find out along the way. I went to a wine tasting one time when mm-hmm. they had some representatives from the different vineyards in Spain. And I went up to some of the representatives and asked them what kind of wine, and I'm afraid I didn't realize I was insulting them because, of course, their wine was so good it would never be mixed with fruit juice. So I really didn't mean to insult them, but I guess I did.
I've done similar things, yeah. Generally, you want not a super heavy-bodied wine, and needless to say, it doesn't have to be expensive, but drinkable. Tempranillo is one to look for. They're usually modestly priced. They're good drinking, but Tempranillo would be one.
Mm-hmm.
Grenache. Yeah, which is a grape, but often the label actually says Grenache. And it's, as I recall, it is a grape that's also used in the Rhone Valley in France. And that, again, is a fruity. It's like the Tempranillo. They tend to be fruity. They tend to be a little bit lighter bodied. They're not big bruisers of wine. So those two would be easy to find. They're not going to be wildly expensive, and they'd be great for making a sangria.
Oh, I am so excited to try these recipes with one of those.
Yeah, just don't tell any Spanish wine expert that you think their wines are wonderful, you know, for sangria. Because they get a little touchy.
I think so.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Henry Miller. He said, "The moment one gives close attention to anything, even a blade of grass, it becomes a mysterious, awesome, indescribable, magnificent world in itself." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by the Poetry Foundation in support of poetry on American Public Media programs. More information online at poetryfoundation.org. Now, information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Have a visit. You're going to find podcasts, newsletters, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin and Judy Graham. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. You have a great week, and please join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.